Chapter 20. Sean came through from the bathroom, his beard in wild disorder, and a bath towel round his waist. The Grand Old Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. He marched them up to the top of the hill, and he marched them down again, he sang as he poured bay rum from a cut glass bottle into his cupped hands and rubbed it into his hair. Duff sat in one of the gilt chairs, watching him. Sean combed his hair carefully, then smiled at himself in the mirror. "You magnificent creature," Sean told his reflection. "You're getting fat," Duff grunted. Sean looked hurt. "It's muscle. You've got a backside on you like a hippopotamus." Sean removed his towel and turned his back to the mirror. He surveyed it over his shoulder. "I need a heavy hammer to drive a long nail," he protested. "Oh, no," groaned Duff. "Your wit at this time of the morning is like pork for breakfast, heavy on the stomach." Sean took a silk shirt out of his drawer, held it like a toreador's cape, made two passes, and swirled it onto his back with a half Veronica. "Olé!" applauded Duff wryly. Sean pulled on his trousers and sat to fit his boots. "You're in a nice mood this morning," he told Duff. "I've just come through an emotional hurricane." "What's the trouble?" "Candy wants a church wedding." "Is that bad?" "Well, it's not good."
"Why?"
"Is your memory so short?"
"Oh, you mean your other wife?"
"That's right, my other wife."
"Have you told Candy about her?"
"Good God, no." Duff looked horrified.
"Yes, I can see your problem.
What about Candy's husband? Doesn't that even the score between you?"
"No, he has gone to his reward."
"Well, that's convenient. Does anybody else know you're married already?"
Duff shook his head.
"What about Francoise?"
"No, I never told him."
"Well, what's your problem? Take her down to the church and marry her."
Duff looked uncomfortable.
"I don't mind marrying a second time in a magistrate's court. It would be only a couple of old Dutchmen I'd be cheating, but to go into a church..." Duff shook his head.
"I'd be the only one who knows," said Sean.
"You and the head man."
"Duff," Sean beamed at him. "Duff, my boy, you have scruples. This is amazing."
Duff squirmed a little in his chair.
"Let me think." Sean held his forehead dramatically.
"Yes, yes, it's coming to me.
That's it.
Come on, tell me." Duff sat on the edge of his chair.
"Go to Candy and tell her it's all fixed. Not only are you prepared to marry her in a church, but you're even going to build your own church."
"Oh, that's wonderful," Duff murmured sarcastically. "That's the way out of my difficulties, all right."
"Let me finish."
Sean started filling his silver cigar case.
"You also tell her that you want a civil ceremony as well. I believe that's what royalty do. Tell her that, it should win her over."
"I still don't follow you."
"Then you build your own chapel up at Xanadu. We can find a distinguished-looking character, dress him up in a dog collar and teach him the right words. That keeps Candy happy. After the service, the priest takes the coach for Cape Town. You take Candy down to the magistrate's office. And that keeps you happy."
Duff looked stunned. Then slowly his face broke into a great happy smile.
"Genius! Pure inspired genius!"
Sean buttoned his waistcoat.
"Think nothing of it. And now, if you'll excuse me, I'll go and do some work. One of us has to make sufficient to allow you to indulge these strange fancies of yours."
Sean shrugged on his coat, picked up his cane and swung it. The gold head gave it a balance like a handmade shotgun. The silk next to his skin and the halo of bay rum round his head made him feel good. He went down the stairs, Embijeni had the carriage waiting for him in the hotel yard. The body tilted slightly at Sean's weight, and the leather upholstery welcomed him with a yielding softness. He lit his first cigar of the day, and Embijeni smiled at him.
"I see you in Kosi." "I see you also, Embijeni. What is that lump on the side of your head?"
"In Kosi I was a little drunk. Otherwise that ape of Basutu would never have touched me with his fighting stick."
Embijeni rolled the carriage smoothly out of the yard and into the street.
"What were you fighting about?"
Embijeni shrugged.
"Must a man have a reason to fight?"
"It's usual."
"It is in my memory that there was a woman," said Embijeni.
"That is also usual. Who won this fight?"
"The man bled a little. His friends took him away. The woman, when I left her, was smiling in her sleep."
Sean laughed, then ran his eyes over the undulating plain of Embijeni's bare back. It was definitely not in keeping. He hoped his secretary had remembered to speak to the tailor. They pulled up in front of his offices. One of his clerks hurried down off the veranda and opened the door of the carriage.
"Good morning, Mr. Courtney."
Sean went up the stairs, with his clerk running ahead of him like a hunting dog.
"Good morning, Mr. Courtney,"
another polite chorus from the row of desks in the main office. Sean waved his cane at them and went through into his own office. His portrait leered down at him from above the fireplace, and he winked at it.
"What have we this morning, Johnson?"
"These requisitions, sir, and the paycheck, sir, and development reports from the engineers, sir, and..."
Johnson was a greasy-haired little man in a greasy-looking alpaca coat. With each "sir," he made a greasy little bow. He was efficient, so Sean hired him, but that didn't mean he liked him.
"You got a stomachache, Johnson?"
"No, sir."
"Well, for God's sake, stand up straight, man."
Johnson shot to attention.
"Now, let's have them one at a time."
Sean dropped into his chair. At this time of the day came the grind. He hated the paperwork, and so he tackled it with grim concentration, making random checks on the long rows of figures, trying to associate names with faces, and querying requisitions that appeared exorbitant, until finally he wrote his signature between the last of Johnson's carefully penciled crosses and threw his pen onto the desk.
"What else is there?"
"Meeting with Mr. Maxwell from the bank at 12:30, sir."
"And then?"
"The agent for Brook Brothers at 1, and immediately after that, Mr. McDougall, sir. Then you're expected at the Candy Deep Mine."
"Thank you, Johnson. I'll be at the exchange as usual this morning if anything out of the ordinary comes up."
"Very good, Mr. Courtney. Just one other thing."
Johnson pointed at the brown paper parcel on the couch across the room.
"From your tailor."
"Ah," Sean smiled. "Send my servant in here." He walked across and opened the parcel. Within a few minutes, Embijeni filled the doorway.
"Nkosi?"
"Embijeni, your new uniform."
Sean pointed at the clothes laid out on the couch. Embijeni's eyes switched to the gold and maroon finery, his expression suddenly dead.
"Put it on. Come on, let's see how you look."
Embijeni crossed to the couch and picked up the jacket.
"These are for me?"
"Yes, come on. Put it on,"
Sean laughed. Embijeni hesitated. Then slowly he loosened his loincloth and let it drop. Sean watched him impatiently as he buttoned on the jacket and pantaloons. Then he walked in a critical circle around the Zulu.
"Not bad," he muttered. And then in Zulu, "Is it not beautiful?"
Embijeni wriggled his shoulders against the unfamiliar feel of the cloth and said nothing.
"Well, Embijeni, do you like it?"
"When I was a child, I went with my father to trade cattle at Port Natal. There was a man
went about the town with a monkey on a chair. The monkey danced, and the people laughed and threw money to it. That monkey had a suit such as this, and Kosi, I do not think he was a very happy monkey.
The smile slipped off Sean's face. Would you rather wear your skins?
What I wear is the dress of a warrior of Zululand.
There was still no expression on Ember Janie's face. Sean opened his mouth to argue with him, but before he could speak, he lost his temper.
You'll wear that uniform, he shouted. You'll wear what I tell you to wear, and you'll do it with a smile, do you hear me?
Nkosi, I hear you.
Ember Janie picked up his loincloth of leopard tails and left the office. When Sean went out to the carriage, Ember Janie was sitting on the driver's seat in his new livery. All the way to the exchange, his back was stiff with protest, and neither of them spoke. Sean glared at the doorman of the exchange, drank 4 brandies during the morning, rode back to his office again at noon, scowling at Ember Janie's still protesting back. Shouted at Johnson, snapped at the bank manager, routed the representative from Brooks Brothers, and drove out to the Candy Deep in a high old rage. But Ember Janie's silence was impenetrable, and Sean couldn't reopen the argument without sacrifice of pride. He burst into the new administrative building of the Candy Deep and threw the staff into confusion.
"Where's Mr. Dutoit?" he roared.
"He's down the number 3 shaft, Mr. Courtney.
What the hell is he doing down there? He's supposed to be waiting for me here."
"He didn't expect you for another hour, sir."
"Well, get me some overalls and a mining helmet. Don't just stand there."
He clapped the tin hat on his head and stamped his heavy gumboots across to the number 3 shaft. A skip dropped him smoothly 500 feet into the earth, and he climbed out at the 10th level.
"Where's Mr. Dutoit?"
he demanded of the shift boss at the lift station.
"He's up at the face, sir."
The floor of the drive was rough and muddy. His gumboots squelched as he set off down the tunnel. His carbide lamp lit the uneven rock walls with a flat white light, and he felt himself starting to sweat. 2 natives pushing a cocoa pan back along the railway lines forced him to flatten himself against one wall to allow them to pass, and while he waited, he felt inside his overalls for his cigar case. As he pulled it out, it slipped from his hand and plunked into the mud. The cocoa pan was gone by the time, so he stooped to pick up the case. His ear came within an inch of the wall, and a puzzled expression replaced his frown of annoyance. The rock was squeaking. He laid his ear against it. It sounded like someone grinding his teeth. He listened to it for a while, trying to guess the cause. It wasn't the echo of shovels or drills. It wasn't water. He walked another 30 yards or so down the drive and listened again. Not so loud here, but now the grinding noise was punctuated with an occasional metallic snap, like the breaking of a knife blade. Strange, very strange. He'd never heard anything like it before. He walked on down the drive, his bad mood lost in his preoccupation with this new problem. Before he reached the face, he met Francois.
"Hello, Mr. Courtney."
Sean had long since given up trying to stop Francois calling him that.
"God, I'm sorry I wasn't there to meet you. I thought you were coming at 3.
"That's all right, Francois. How are you?"
"My rheumatism's been giving me blazes, Mr. Courtney, but otherwise I'm all right. How's Mr. Charleywood?"
"He's fine."
Sean couldn't restrain his curiosity any longer. "Tell me something, Franz. Just now I put my ear against the wall of the drive and I heard an odd noise. I couldn't make out what it was."
"What kind of noise?"
"Sort of grinding, Sean searched for words to describe it. "Like 2 pieces of glass being rubbed together."
Francois's eyes flew wide open and then began to bulge. The colour of his face changed to grey, and he caught Sean's arm. Where?
Back along the drive.
The breath jammed in Francois's throat, and he struggled to speak through it, shaking Sean's arm desperately.
Cave in, he croaked. Cave in, man!
He started to run, but Sean grabbed him. Francois struggled wildly.
Francois, how many men are up at the face?
Cave in!
Francois's voice was now hysterically shrill.
Cave in!
He broke Sean's grip and raced away towards the lift station, the mud flying from his gumboots. His terror infected Sean, and he ran a dozen paces after Francois before he stopped himself. For precious seconds he wavered, with fear slithering around like a reptile in his stomach. Go back to call the others and perhaps die with them, or follow Francois and live. Then the fear in his belly found a mate, a thing just as slimy and cold. Its name was shame, and shame it was that drove him back towards the face. There were five blacks and a white man there, bare-chested and shiny with sweat in the heat. Sean shouted those two words at them, and they reacted the way bathers do when someone on the beach shouts shark. The same moment of paralyzed horror, then the panic. They came stampeding back along the tunnel. Sean ran with them. The mud sucked at his heavy boots, and his legs were weak with easy living and riding in carriages. One by one, the others passed him. "Wait for me," he wanted to scream. "Wait for me!" He slipped on the greasy footing, scraped his shoulder on the rough wall as he fell, and dragged himself up again, mud plastered in his beard, the blood humming in his ears. Alone now, he plundered on down the tunnel. With a crack, like a rifle shot, one of the thick, shoring timbers broke under the pressure of the moving rock, and dust smoked from the roof of the tunnel in front of him. He staggered on, and all around him the earth was talking, groaning, protesting with little muffled shrieks. The timbers joined in again, crackling and snapping, and as slowly as a theatre curtain the rock sagged down from above him. The tunnel was thick with dust that smothered the beam of his lamp and rasped his throat. He knew then that he wasn't going to make it, but he ran on with the loose rock starting to fall about him. A lump hit his mining helmet and jarred him so that he nearly fell. Blinded by the swirling dust fog, he crashed on at full run into the abandoned cocoa pan that blocked the tunnel. He sprawled over the metal body of the trolley with his thighs bruised from the collision. Now I'm finished, he thought, but instinctively he pulled himself up and started to grope his way around the cocoa pan to continue his flight. With a roar, the tunnel in front of him collapsed. He dropped on his knees and crawled between the wheels of the cocoa pan, wriggling under the sturdy steel body just an instant before the roof above him collapsed also. The noise of the fall around him seemed to last forever. But then it was over. And the rustling and grating of the rock as it settled down was almost silence in comparison. His lamp was lost, and the darkness pressed as heavily on him as the earth squeezed down on his tiny shelter. The air was solid with dust, and he coughed. He coughed until his chest ached, and he tasted salty blood in his mouth. There was hardly room to move. The steel body of the trolley was 6 inches above him, but he struggled until he managed to open the front of his overalls and tear a piece off the tail of his shirt. He held the silk like a surgical mask across his mouth and nose. It strained the dust out of the air so he could breathe. The dust settled. His coughing slowed and finally stopped. He felt surprised that he was still alive, and cautiously he started exploring. He tried to straighten out his legs, but his feet touched rock. He felt with his hands, 6 inches of headroom and perhaps 12 inches on either side, warm mud underneath him, and rock and steel all around. He took off his helmet and used it as a pillow. He was in a steel coffin, buried 500 feet deep. He felt the first flutter of panic. Keep your mind busy. Think of something.
think of anything but the rock around you. Count your assets, he told himself. He started to search his pockets, moving with difficulty in the cramped space. One silver cigar case with two Havanas. He laid it down next to him. One box of matches, wet. He placed it on top of the case. One pocket watch. One handkerchief, Irish linen, monogrammed. One comb, tortoiseshell. A man is judged by his appearance. He started to comb his beard, but found immediately that though this occupied his hands, it left his mind free. He put the comb down next to his matches. £25 in gold sovereigns. He counted them carefully. Yes, 25. I shall order a bottle of good champagne. The dust was chalky in his mouth, so he went on hurriedly, and a Malay girl from the opera. No, why be mean? 10 Malay girls, I'll have them dance for me, that'll pass the time. I'll promise them a sovereign each to bolster their enthusiasm. He continued the search, but there was nothing else.
Gumboots, socks, well-cut trousers, torn shirt, I'm afraid, overalls, tin hat, and that's all.
With his possessions laid out carefully beside him and his cell explored, he had to start thinking. First he thought about his thirst. The mud in which he lay was too thick to yield water. He tried straining it through his shirt without success. And then he thought about air. It seemed quite fresh, and he decided that sufficient was filtering in from the loosely packed rock around him to keep him alive. To keep him alive. Alive until the thirst killed. Until he died curled up like a fetus in the warm womb of the earth. He laughed, a worm in a dark, warm womb. He laughed again and recognized it as the beginnings of panic. He thrust his fist into his mouth to stop himself, biting down hard on his knuckles. It was very quiet. The rock had stopped moving. How long will it take? Tell me, doctor, how long have I got? Well, you are sweating. You'll lose moisture quite rapidly. I'd say about 4 days, he answered himself. What about hunger, doctor? Oh, don't worry about that. You'll be hungry, of course, but the thirst will kill you. And typhoid, or is it typhus? I can never remember. What about that, doctor? If there were dead men trapped in here with you, there'd be a good chance. But you're alone, you know. Do you think I'll go mad, doctor? Not immediately, of course, but in a few days. Yes, you'll go mad. I've never been mad before, not that I know of anyway, but I think it will help to go mad now, don't you? If you mean, will it make it easier? Well, I don't know. Ah, now you're being obscure, but I follow you. You mean, in that sleep of madness, what dreams will come? You mean, will madness be more real than reality? You mean, will dying mad be worse than dying thirsty? But then, I may beat the madness. This cocoa pan might buckle under the strain. After all, there must be thousands of tons of rock bearing down on it. That's very clever, you know, doctor. As a medical man, you should appreciate it. Mother Earth was saved, but alas, the child was stillborn. She bore down too hard. Sean had spoken aloud, and now he felt foolish. He picked up a piece of stone and tapped the cocoa pan with it. Sounds firm enough. A most pleasing noise, really. He beat harder on the metal body. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Then he dropped the stone. Soft as an echo, distant as the moon, he heard his taps repeated. His whole body stiffened at the sound, and he started to shiver with excitement. He snatched up the stone. 3 times he rapped, and 3 times the answer came back to him. They heard me. Sweet, merciful Christ, they heard me. He laughed breathlessly. Dear Mother Earth, don't bear down. Please don't bear down. Just be patient. Wait a few days, and by caesarean, they'll take this child out of your womb. Embijani waited until Sean disappeared down the number 3 shaft before he took off his new jacket. He folded it carefully on the driver's seat next to him. He sat and enjoyed the feel of the sun on his skin for a while. Then he climbed off the carriage and went to the horses. He took them one at a time to the trough for water, then returned them to their harnesses, buckling them in loosely. He picked up his spears from the footboard and moved across to a patch of short grass next to the administrative building. He sat down and went to work on the blade, humming softly to himself as he honed. At last he ran an expert thumb along each edge, grunted, shaved a few hairs off his forearm, smiled contentedly, and laid his spears beside him in the grass. He lay back, and the sun warmed him to sleep. The shouting woke him. He sat up and automatically checked the height of the sun. He had slept an hour or more. Duff was shouting, and Francois, mud-splattered and frightened-looking, was answering him. They were standing together in front of the administrative building. Duff's horse was sweating. Embijani stood up and went across to them. He listened closely, trying to understand their staccato voices. They went too fast for him, but something was wrong, that much he knew. "It's caved in almost to the number 10 lift station," Francois said. "You left him in there?" accused Duff. "I thought he was following me, but he turned back." "What for? Why did he turn back?" "To call the others."
"Have you started clearing the drive?"
"No, I was waiting for you."
"You bloody stupid idiot. He might be alive in there. Every minute is vital."
"But he hasn't a chance, Mr. Charleywood. He must be dead."
"Shut up, damn you."
Duff swung away from him and started running towards the shaft. There was a crowd gathered beneath the high steel structure of the headgear, and suddenly Embijani knew it was Sean. He caught up with Duff before he reached the shaft.
"Is it the Nkosi?"
"Yes."
"What has happened?"
"The rock has fallen on him." Embijani pushed his way into the skip next to Duff, and neither of them spoke again until they reached the 10th level. They went down the drive, only a short way before they reached the end. There were men there with crowbars and shovels, standing undecided, waiting for orders, and Embijani shouldered a path through them. He and Duff stood together in front of the new wall of broken rock that sealed the tunnel, and the silence went on and on.
Then Duff turned on the white shift boss.
Were you at the face?
Yes.
He went back to call you, didn't he?
Yes. And you left him there. The man couldn't look at Duff.
I thought he was following us, he muttered.
You thought only of your own miserable skin, Duff told him. You filthy little coward. You slimy yellow bastard. You...
Member Janey caught Duff's arm, and Duff stopped his tirade.
They all heard it then. Clink, clink, clink.
It's him. It must be him, whispered Duff. He's alive.
He snatched a crowbar from one of the natives and knocked against the side of the tunnel. They waited, their breathing the only sound, until the answer came back to them louder and sharper than before. MB Janey took the crowbar out of Duff's hands. He thrust it into a crack in the rock jamb, and his back muscles bunched as he heaved. The bar bent like a licorice stick. He threw it away and went at the stone with his bare hands.
You, Duff snapped at the shift boss. We'll need timber to shore up as we clear the fall. Get it!
He turned to the natives. Four of you working on the face at one time. The rest of you carry the stone away as we loosen it.
Do you want any dynamite? Asked the shift boss.
And bring the rock down a second time. Use your brains, man. Go and get that timber, and call Mr. Dutoit while you're at the surface.
In 4 hours they cleared 15 feet of tunnel, breaking the largest slabs of stone with sledgehammers and prizing the pieces out of the jam.
Duff's body ached, and his hands were raw. He had to rest. He walked slowly back to the lift station, and there he found blankets and a huge dish of soup.
Where did this come from?
Candy's Hotel, sir. Half Johannesburg is waiting at the head of the shaft.
Duff huddled into a blanket and drank a little of the soup.
Where's Dutoit?
I couldn't find him, sir. Up at the face, Ember Janey worked on. The first four natives came back to rest and fresh men took their place. Ember Janey led them, grunting an order occasionally, but otherwise reserving his strength for the assault on the rock. For an hour Duff rested, and when he returned to the head of the tunnel, Ember Janey was still there. Duff watched him curl his arms round a piece of stone the size of a beer keg, brace his legs and tear the stone out of the jam. Earth and loose rock followed it, burying Ember Janey's legs to the knees, and Duff jumped forward to help him.
Another 2 hours, and Duff had to rest again. This time he led Ember Janey back with him, gave him a blanket and made him drink a little soup.
They sat next to each other, with their backs against the wall of the tunnel and blankets over their shoulders. The shift boss came to Duff.
Mrs. Rottenbach sent this down for you, sir.
It was a half bottle of brandy.
Tell her thank you.
Duff pulled the cork with his teeth and swallowed twice. It brought the tears into his eyes. He offered the bottle to Ember Janey.
It is not fitting, Ember Janey demurred.
Drink.
Ember Janey drank, wiped the mouth of the bottle carefully on his blanket and handed it back.
Duff took another swallow and offered it again, but Ember Janey shook his head.
A little of that is strength. Too much is weakness. There is work to do now.
Duff corked the bottle.
How long before we reach him? Asked Ember Janey.
Another day, maybe two.
A man can die in 2 days, mused the Zulu.
Not one with a body like a bull and a temper like a devil, Duff assured him.
Ember Janey smiled, and Duff went on groping for his words in Zulu.
You love him, Ember Janey. Love is a woman's word.
Ember Janey inspected one of his thumbs
The nail was torn loose, standing up like a tombstone. He took it between his teeth, pulled it off, and spat it onto the floor of the drive. Duff shuddered as he watched. "Those baboons will not work unless they are driven," Mbijeni stood up. "Are you rested?" "Yes," lied Duff, and they went back to the face. Sean lay in the mud, with his head on the hard pillow of the helmet. The darkness was as solid as the rock around him. He tried to imagine where the one ended and the other began. By doing that, he could stop himself feeling his thirst so strongly. He could hear the ring of hammer on stone and the rattle of rock falling free, but it never seemed to come any closer. The whole side of his body was stiff and sore, but he could not turn over. His knees caught on the cocoa pan every time he tried, and the air in his little cave was starting to taste stale. His head ached. He moved again, restlessly, and his hand brushed the small pile of sovereigns. He struck at them, scattering them into the mud. They were the bait that had led him into this trap. Now he would give them and all the millions of others just for the feel of the wind in his beard and the sun in his face. The darkness clung to him, thick and cloying as black treacle. It seemed to fill his nose, his throat and eyes, smothering him. He groped and found the matchbox. For a few seconds of light, he would burn up most of the precious oxygen in his cave and call it fair exchange. But the box was sodden. He struck match after match, but the wet heads crumbled without a spark, and he threw them away and clenched his eyelids to keep the darkness out. Bright colours formed in front of his eyes, moving and rearranging themselves, until suddenly and very clearly they formed a picture of Garrick's face. He hadn't thought about his family for months. He'd been too busy reaping the golden harvest. But now memories crowded back. There were so many things he had forgotten. Everything else had become unimportant when compared with power and gold. Even lives, men's lives, had meant nothing. But now it was his own life teetering on the edge of the black cliff. The sound of the sledgehammers broke into his thoughts again. There were men on the other side of the blocked tunnel trying to save him, working their way into the treacherous rock pile which might collapse again at any minute. People were more valuable than the poisonous metal, the little gold discs that lay smugly beside him in the mud while men struggled to save him. He thought of Gary, crippled by his careless shotgun. Father to the bastard he had sired. Of Ada, whom he had left without a word of goodbye. Of Karl Lochkamper, with a pistol in his hand and half his head splattered across the floor of his bedroom. Of other nameless men dead or broken because of him. Sean ran his tongue across his lips and listened to the hammers. He was certain they were nearer now.
"If I get out of here, it'll be different. I swear it."
Mbijeni rested for 4 hours in the next 36. Duff watched the flesh melt off him in sweat. He was killing himself. Duff was worn out. He could no longer work with his hands, but he was directing the teams who were shoring up the reclaimed tunnel. By the second evening, they had cleared 100 feet of the drive. Duff paced it out, and when he reached the face, he spoke to Mbijeni. How long since you last signalled to him? Ember Janey stepped back with a sledgehammer in his tattered hands. Its shaft was sticky and brown with blood.
1 hour ago. And even then it sounded as though there were but the length of a spear between us.
Duff took a crowbar from one of the other natives and tapped the rock. The answer came immediately. "He's hitting something made of iron," Duff said. "Sounds as though he's only a few feet away. Ember Janey, let those other men take over. If you wish, you can stay and watch, but you must rest again now." For answer, Ember Janey lifted the hammer and swung it against the face. The rock he hit cracked, and two of the natives stepped up and levered it loose with their crowbars. At the back of the hole it left in the wall, they could see the corner of the cocoa pan. Everyone stared at it. Then Duff shouted,
"Sean! Sean! Can you hear me? Stop talking! And get me out of here!"
Sean's voice was hoarse with thirst and dust and muffled by the rock.
"He's under the cocoa pan. It's him. Nkosi, are you all right? We found him."
The shouts were picked up by the men working behind them in the drive and passed back to those waiting at the lift station. "They found him. He's all right. They found him." Duff and Ember Janey jumped forward together, their exhaustion completely forgotten. They cleared the last few lumps of rock, and with their shoulders touching, knelt and peered under the cocoa pan.
"Nkosi, I see you."
"I see you also, Ember Janey. What took you so long?"
"Nkosi, there were a few small stones in the way."
Ember Janey reached under the cocoa pan and with his hands under Sean's armpits pulled him out.
"What a hell of a place you chose to go to ground in, laddie.
How are you feeling?"
"Give me some water and I'll be all right."
"Water! Bring water!" shouted Duff.
Sean gulped it, trying to drink the whole mug in one mouthful. He coughed and it shot out of his nose.
"Easy, laddie, easy."
Duff thumped his back. Sean drank the next mugful more slowly and finished, panting from the effort.
"That was good.
Come on, we've got a doctor waiting on top." Duff draped a blanket over his shoulders. Ember Janey picked Sean up across his chest.
"Put me down, damn you.
I haven't forgotten how to walk." Ember Janey set him down gently, but his legs buckled like those of a man just out of bed from a long illness, and he clutched at Ember Janey's arm. Ember Janey picked him up again and carried him down to the lift station. They rode up in the skip into the open.
"The moon's shining. And the stars. My God, they're beautiful."
There was wonder in Sean's voice. He sucked the night air into his lungs, but it was too rich for him, and he started coughing again. There were people waiting at the head of the shaft, and they crowded round them as they stepped out of the skip.
"How is he? Are you all right, Sean?"
"Doc Simmons is waiting in the office."
"Quickly, Ember Janey," said Duff. "Get him out of the cold."
One on either side of him, they hurried Sean across the administrative building and laid him on the couch in Francois's office. Simmons checked him over, looked down his throat and felt his pulse.
"Have you got a closed carriage here?"
"Yes," Duff answered. "We'll wrap him up warmly and get him home to bed. With dust and bad air he's been breathing, there's serious danger of pneumonia. I'll come down with you and give him a sedative."
"I won't need one, Doc," Sean grinned at him.
"I think I know what's best for you, Mr. Courtney," Dr. Simmons said. He was a young man, a fashionable doctor among the rich of Johannesburg, and he took it very seriously. Now, if you please, we'll get you to your hotel. He started to pack his instruments back into his valise. You're the doctor, Sean agreed. But before we go, will you have a look at my servant's hands? They're in a hell of a mess. There's hardly any meat left on them. Dr. Simmons did not look up from what he was doing. I have no Kaffir practice, Mr. Courtney. I'm sure you'll find some other doctor to attend to him when we get back to town. Sean sat up slowly. He let the blanket slip off his shoulders. He walked across to Dr. Simmons and held him by the throat against the wall. The doctor had a fine pair of waxed moustaches, and Sean took one of them between the thumb and forefinger of his free hand. He plucked it out like feathers from the carcass of a dead fowl, and Dr. Simmons squealed. "Starting now, Doctor, you have a Kaffir practice," Sean told him. He pulled the handkerchief out of Simmons' top pocket and dabbed with the little drops of blood on the doctor's bare upper lip. "Be a good fellow. See to my servant,"